gusta lo mejor. A mujeres no me falta ni el dinero ni el amor. Jineteando en mi caballo por la sierra yo me voy. Las estrellas y la luna ellas me dicen dónde voy.
Ay, 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 ay,
ay, ay, ay, mi amor.
Ay, mi morena de mi corazón.
Me gusta tocar guitarra, me gusta cantar el son. Mariachi me acompaña cuando canto mi canción. Me gusta tomar mis copas, aguardiente es lo mejor. También el tequila blanco con su sal le da sabor.
Ay, 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 ay.
Ay, ay, mi amor.
Ay, mi morena de mi corazón.
Me gusta tocar guitarra, me gusta cantar el son. El mariachi me acompaña cuando canto mi canción. Me gusta tomar mis copas, aguardiente es lo mejor. También el tequila blanco con su sal le da sabor.
Ay, 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 ay.
Ay, ay, mi amor.
Ay, mi morena de mi corazón.
Ay, 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 ay.
Ay, ay, mi amor.
Ay, mi morena de mi corazón.
Welcome and thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just joining us, we're listening to Chris Hedges talk about his book, The Empire of Illusion, in the style of an Old Testament prophet. Chris Hedges decries the coming capitalist totalitarianism and urges activists to promote democratic socialism. Journalist Chris Hedges discusses the dramatic rise of a post-literate society that craves fantasy, ecstasy, and illusion. And now here is Chris Hedges.
I knew a guy in Sarajevo who spray painted on the side of his car. He did not have an armored. I had an armored. Save your bullets, I'm immortal. And he used to make a mad dash across the tarmac, separating the airport tarmac, separating the besieged city from the next Croatian town to buy cigars. I mean, it was just foolish. Buy the cigars, come back smoking the cigars, and of course the Serb snipers would shoot at him. He is now today a cripple. That a sober reading of reality is the best possibility for survival and hope. And if we continue within a state of illusion, then hope becomes impossible because every decision we make is not reality-based. And you can see it with the financial disfiguration of the country. The theory behind pumping this kind of liquidity into the market is that the banks and the corporations will then, when the money runs out next year, put the liquidity into the market. Well, it's very clear that they're doing what all good capitalists would do with our money, which is hanging on to it. And we're screwed. That is an example of an illusion. Well, there is no working class. I don't have a belief in a working class movement because we've destroyed our working class. And traditionally social movements have been built around a working class. But now we have a new paradigm where nobody has any jobs. I mean, the working class are people who are working 28 hours a week in Walmart. And, as soon as they raise the slightest issue of dissonance with their supervisor, Walmart sends their SWAT teams in by jet to make sure they and all the people they've contaminated in the store don't have a job. And I don't know how we're going to build it because it's a paradigm that we've not seen before. It is a paradigm that its inevitable result is a form of neo-feudalism, and we're already very far down that road.
So we have time for a couple more questions. And
hi. Thanks a lot for your work. I had a question mainly around what your vision of socialism is that you are saying,
That's a good question.
And how would you suggest one gets there? But I also wanted to mention that I see the connection between, you know, war is a thing that gives us meaning and the sort of illusionary things that you're talking
yeah.
about now, which builds on that same need.
Yeah,
anyway,
I think you're right. Well, I gave a talk at the University of Winnipeg a few weeks ago and thought, as usual, that I was delivering an incendiary and radical message. And there was this grim-faced group of economics professors after I finished who were there. The whole economics department was there, and one of them stood up and said, "We want to make it clear to everyone in this room that you are nothing but a radical Keynesian." The economics department at the University of Winnipeg is uniformly Marxist. That's Canada for you. When I talk about socialism, I am a radical Keynesian. I talk about Swedish socialism. I've lived in France. I've lived in Europe. I'm talking about universal health care. I'm talking about full employment. I'm not a Marxist. I come out of Hannah Arendt, who was a socialist, a democratic European socialist, Karl Popper. I mean, these are the Reinhold Niebuhr. These are the great foundational moral philosophers for me. Upton Sinclair, I mean, someone mentioned he was a socialist. I mean, there was a powerful socialist movement in this country, but Woodrow Wilson used the Sedition and the Espionage Act to essentially destroy it, to destroy the age of the muckrakers. And then after the war, that very swift transition from the hated Hun to the Red Scare. And it had the twin purpose of promoting war and destroying progressive social movements. And I think we have to begin to reclaim those movements. Because socialism, for me, is about the common good. It's about not throwing your mentally ill on heating grates in the street. It's about not allowing children in your country to go to bed hungry. It's about making sure that every American, no matter how poor, has access to decent medical care, a public education, the chance to go to university. I mean, my son's at Colgate University. It costs $51,000 a year. Can you imagine if they tried that in France? The French university students would shut the country down. And these kids are borrowing staggering sums of money, and they're not going to get the jobs to repay it. And there's probably some in this room.
There's one more question.
Last summer, I read a book by Marianne Wolf titled Proust and the Squid, where she describes what happens to a child that, you know, can learn how to read, you know, with dyslexia and a whole host of learning disabilities. And in that book, there's a little passage where she talks about Socrates and how Socrates, you know, came from this oral tradition, and he was, you know, railing against, you know, books and, you know, talking about how books are going to come to impoverish the new culture. You know, because he belonged to this oral tradition, and he used to, you know, think, well, you know, you memorize things and your experience with human beings is richer. Whereas, you know, you read a book and there's no feedback. Now, I don't know if anybody would argue that books have not been good for humanity for the past 2,500 years. I'm not sure that Socrates could have envisioned, you know, the library at Alexandria and maybe the 42nd Street Library here and you know. But my question is, we're moving, you know, like you say, from a print-based literate society to an image-based society. And I'm wondering, you know, whether, you know, we're moving from a society that's you know, print-based to an electronic society, and where is this electronic thing going? You know, I mean, I look at the, you know, the Nook and the Kindle, and now you have the power to carry, you know, 60 books. Don't think you have time to read 60 books, but you have the power to carry it. And I'm just wondering if you can make a comment as to, you know, where Socrates was criticizing books and where we are now criticizing this electronic image-based society.
Socrates' fear, and Socrates understood, in the same way that Jesus understood and St. Francis understood, that when moral philosophy becomes written down, when it is written down, in the words of Steiner, it freezes speech. It becomes a form of orthodoxy. And that's what terrified Socrates, that dialogue that struggle for the moral life was too ambiguous to ever be codified. And of course, Socrates' greatest disciple, Plato, was a fascist. So he was correctly talking about the danger of taking moral philosophy, which is a form of questioning, and writing it down so that it became a kind of orthodoxy. In terms of the internet, you don't read on the internet. Anybody who's ever tried to read a 5 or 10,000 word piece on the internet, if they can do it, you print it out. The internet is, and you know, even if you look at the homepage of the New York Times, it's movement, strobe light, flashing. When I first came back from overseas to New York, one of the hardest things to adjust to was how all images around me moved. And so 2 or 3 times a week I retreated into the Metropolitan Museum of Art because I could stand and reflect on something that didn't move. And you look at my son's generation who are texting and twittering and listening to music, and it has the capacity to destroy thought. Thought is done in solitude and silence. And we live in a culture where we fear any kind of solitude, and we have created such powerful systems of technology. And most of us are hallucinating. We are completely disconnected from the real, from what's real. We've created a virtual reality that we mistake for the real. And as somebody who covered war, one of the most frustrating things, and this is true for veterans or anyone who's come back, is that the graphic depictions of violence, Saving Private Ryan, are so powerful that people think they understand the reality of war. So that those of us who have been to war, we can't compete against those images. We can't compete against the lie of those images, because those images have made people feel as if they have had an experience. But they have been manipulated very skillfully by image makers and turned in a particular direction. Most people who have been in combat, one of the reasons they have such a difficult time speaking about it, and the Army did a study about combat veterans, Army psychologists, that said that for soldiers and Marines who had been in combat, it was the emotional equivalent to being in a severe car wreck where your best friend is killed. That's what war is like. I don't have dinner anymore with like Princeton professors because I can't debate Afghanistan. I know what 155 howitzer shells do to human bodies. I know what iron fragmentation bombs from F-16s do. I know how when a small unit is pinned down, a first lieutenant has the capacity to utterly obliterate an entire village within a matter of minutes. I know all those realities, and I can't convey it under the absurd rubric that we're liberating the women of Taliban, as if once you use the instrument of industrial violence, there is such a thing as human rights. And when you talk about the intrusion or the power of pseudo-events and images, the internet and handheld devices have become tools which, if misused, make it impossible to think and cut us off from what's real. And we have to be very, very careful with these technologies. It's one of the reasons why I have sent all my kids, including my daughter, who wasn't happy about it, for 7 weeks up on the Allagash, where there was no computer, no cell phone, 7 weeks sleeping on the ground, portaging canoes. So at least she stopped, because that's the real world. That's the real world. And that's the world that if we don't stand up, these corporations are literally going to kill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, say can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations where our children can play in a world without war where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation where the rivers run clean through the forests of green where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our birth, blessed with peace on earth.
A long time forgotten, the dreams that just fell by the way. The good life he promised ain't what she's living today.
Really?
But she never complains of the bad times or the bad things he's done, Lord. Yeah. She just talks about the good times they've had and all the good times to come. She's a good-hearted woman in love with a good time. Him in spite of his ways, she don't understand. Through teardrops and laughter, the past of this world hand in hand. A good-hearted woman, loving a good-hearted man. He likes the bright lights and nightlife. Good time friend. And when the party's all over, she'll welcome him back home again.
Lord knows she don't understand him, but she does the best that she can.
Now this a good-hearted woman loving a good time man.
She's a good-hearted woman in love with a good-timing man. She loves me in spite of my wicked ways that she don't understand. Through teardrops and laughter, the past of this world hand in hand. A good-hearted woman loving a good-timing man. She's a good-hearted woman in love with a good-timing man. She loves me in spite of my Mickey Mouse ways and things she don't understand.
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Oh, can't you see
be me. Ain't nobody just like this. I gotta be me. Baby, hit or miss. Sitting here all by myself, trying to be everybody else. Can't you see? I gotta be me. Ain't nobody just like this. I gotta be me. Baby, hit or miss. Look at you sitting there all by yourself, listening to everybody, everybody say, be everybody else. Can't you see? Gotta be the. Ain't nobody just like you. You gotta be you. Baby, hit or miss. Oh my la 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 la. Be me. Ain't nobody just like this. I gotta be me. Oh, baby, hit or miss. Sitting here, I'm all by myself. I'm trying to be everybody else, but now I see. I gotta be me. Ain't nobody just like this. I gotta be me. Baby, hit or miss. Baby, hit or miss. Hit or miss. Ain't nobody just like this. I gotta be me.
Yeah. That's all, folks.